The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Book 1, Chapter 6, Part 2. I have called the fourth and final division of the spiritual elements into which I should divide heathen humanity by the name of the philosophers. I confess that it covers in my mind much that would generally be classified otherwise, and that what are here called philosophies are very often called religions. I believe, however, that my own description will be found to be much the more realistic and not the less respectful. But we must first take philosophy in its purest and clearest form, that we may trace its normal outline. And that is to be found in the world of the purest and clearest outlines, the culture of the Mediterranean, of which we have been considering the mythologies and idolatries in the last two chapters. Polytheism, or that aspect of paganism, was never to the pagan what Catholicism is to the Catholic. It was never a view of the universe satisfying all sides of life, a complete and complex truth with something to say about everything. It was only a satisfaction of one side of the soul of man, even if we call it the religious side, and I think it is truer to call it the imaginative side. But this it did satisfy. In the end, it satisfied it to satiety. All that world was a tissue of interwoven tales and cults, and there ran in and out of it, as we have already seen, that black thread among its more blameless colors, the darker paganism that was really diabolism. But we all know that this did not mean that all pagan men thought of nothing but pagan gods. Precisely because mythology only satisfied one mood, they turned in other moods to something totally different. But it is very important to realize that it was totally different. It was too different to be inconsistent. While a mob of people were pouring on a public holiday to the feast of Adonis or the games in honor of Apollo, this or that man would prefer to stop at home and think out a little theory about the nature of things. Sometimes his hobby would even take the form of thinking about the nature of God, or even, in that sense, about the nature of the gods. But he very seldom thought of pitting his nature of the gods against the gods of nature. It is necessary to insist on this abstraction in the first student of abstractions. He was not so much antagonistic as absent-minded. His hobby might be the universe, but at first the hobby was as private as if it had been numismatics or playing draughts. And even when his wisdom came to be a public possession, and almost a political situation, it was very seldom on the same plane as the popular and religious institutions. Aristotle, with his colossal common sense, was perhaps the greatest of all philosophers, certainly the most practical of all philosophers. But Aristotle would no more have set up the absolute side by side with the Apollo of Delphi as a similar or rival religion than Archimedes would have thought of setting up the lever as a sort of idol or fetish to be substituted for the palladium of the city. Or we might as well imagine Euclid building an altar to the isosceles triangle, or offering sacrifices to the square of the hypotenuse. The one man meditated on metaphysics as the other man did on mathematics. For the love of truth, or for curiosity, or for the fun of the thing. But that sort of fun never seems to have interfered very much with the other sort of fun. The fun of dancing or singing to celebrate some rascally romance about Zeus becoming a bull or a swan. It is perhaps the proof of a certain superficiality and even insincerity about the popular polytheism that men could be philosophers and even skeptics without disturbing it. These thinkers could move the foundations of the world without altering even the outline of that colored cloud that hung above it in the air. for the thinkers did move the foundations of the world, even when a curious compromise seemed to prevent them from moving the foundations of the city. The two great philosophers of antiquity do indeed appear to us as defenders of sane and even of sacred ideas. Their maxims often read like the answers to skeptical questions, too completely answered to be always recorded. Aristotle annihilated 100 anarchists and nature-worshipping cranks by the fundamental statement that man is a political animal. Plato, in some sense, anticipated the Catholic realism, as attacked by the heretical nominalism, by insisting on the equally fundamental fact that ideas are realities, that ideas exist just as men exist. Plato, however, seems sometimes almost to fancy that ideas exist as men do not exist, or that the men need hardly be considered where they conflict with the ideas. He had something of the social sentiment that we call Fabian in his ideal of fitting the citizen to the city. Like an imaginary head to an ideal hat. And great and glorious as he remains, he has been the father of all faddists. Aristotle anticipated more fully the sacramental sanity that was to combine the body and the soul of things, for he considered the nature of men as well as the nature of morals, and looked to the eyes as well as to the light. But though these great men were, in that sense, constructive and conservative, they belonged to a world where thought was free to the point of being fanciful. Many other great intellects did indeed follow them, some exalting an abstract vision of virtue, others following, more rationalistically, the necessity of the human pursuit of happiness. The former had the name of Stoics, and their name has passed into a proverb for what is indeed one of the main moral ideas of mankind, that of strengthening the mind itself until it is of a texture to resist calamity or even pain. But it is admitted that a great number of the philosophers degenerated into what we still call sophists. They became a sort of professional skeptics who went about asking uncomfortable questions and were handsomely paid for making themselves a nuisance to normal people. It was perhaps an accidental resemblance to such questioning quacks that was responsible for the unpopularity of the great Socrates, whose death might seem to contradict the suggestion of the permanent truce between the philosophers and the gods. But Socrates did not die as a monotheist who denounced polytheism, certainly not as a prophet who denounced idols. It is clear to anyone reading between the lines that there was some notion, right or wrong, of a purely personal influence affecting morals and perhaps politics. The general compromise remained, whether it was that the Greeks thought their myths a joke or that they thought their theories a joke. There was never any collision in which one really destroyed the other, and there was never any combination in which one was really reconciled with the other. They certainly did not work together. If anything, the philosopher was a rival of the priest. But both seemed to have accepted a sort of separation of functions and remained parts of the same social system. Another important tradition descends from Pythagoras, who is significant because he stands nearest to the Oriental mystics who must be considered in their turn. He taught a sort of mysticism of mathematics, that number is the ultimate reality. But he also seems to have taught the transmigration of souls, like the Brahmins, and to have left to his followers certain traditional tricks of vegetarianism and water drinking, very common among the Eastern sages, especially those who figure in fashionable drawing rooms like those of the later Roman Empire. But in passing to Eastern sages and the somewhat different atmosphere of the East, we may approach a rather important truth by another path. One of the great philosophers said that it would be well if philosophers were kings, or kings were philosophers. He spoke as of something too good to be true, but as a matter of fact, it not unfrequently was true. A certain type, perhaps too little noticed in history, may really be called the royal philosopher. To begin with, apart from actual royalty, it did occasionally become possible for the sage, though he was not what we call a religious founder, to be something like a political founder. And the great example of this, one of the very greatest in the world, will, with the very thought of it, carry us thousands of miles across the vast spaces of Asia to that very wonderful, and in some ways that very wise world of ideas and institutions, which we dismiss somewhat cheaply when we talk of China. Men have served many very strange gods, and trusted themselves loyally to many ideals and even idols. China is a society that has really chosen to believe in intellect. It has taken intellect seriously, and it may be that it stands alone in the world. From a very early age, it faced the dilemma of the king and the philosopher by actually appointing a philosopher to advise the king. It made a public institution out of a private individual who had nothing in the world to do but to be intellectual. It had, and has, of course, many other things on the same pattern. It creates all ranks and privileges by public examination. It has nothing that we call an aristocracy. It is a democracy dominated by an intelligentsia. But the point here is that it had philosophers to advise kings, and one of those philosophers must have been a very great philosopher and a great statesman. Confucius was not a religious founder, or even a religious teacher, possibly not even a religious man. He was not an atheist. He was apparently what we call an agnostic. But the really vital point is that it is utterly irrelevant to talk about his religion at all. It is like talking of theology as the first thing in the story of how Rowland Hill established the postal system, or Baden-Powell organized the Boy Scouts. Confucius was not there to bring a message from heaven to humanity, but to organize China. And he must have organized it exceedingly well. It follows that he dealt much with morals, but he bound them up strictly with manners. The peculiarity of his scheme and of his country, to which it contrasts with its great pendant, the system of Christendom, is that he insisted on perpetuating an external life with all its forms, that outward continuity might preserve internal peace. Anyone who knows how much habit has to do with health, of mind as well as of body, will see the truth in his idea. But he will also see that the ancestor worship and the reverence for the sacred emperor were habits and not creeds. It is unfair to the great Confucius to say that he was a religious founder. It is even unfair to him to say that he was not a religious founder. It is as unfair as going out of one's way to say that Jeremy Bentham was not a Christian martyr. But there is a class of most interesting cases in which philosophers were kings and not merely the friends of kings. The combination is not accidental. It has a great deal to do with this rather elusive question of the function of the philosopher. It contains in it some hint of why philosophy and mythology seldom came to an open rupture. It was not only because there was something a little frivolous about the mythology. It was also because there was something a little supercilious about the philosopher. He despised the myths, but he also despised the mob, and he thought they suited each other. The pagan philosopher was seldom a man of the people, at any rate in spirit. He was seldom a democrat, and often a bitter critic of democracy. He had about him an air of aristocratic and humane leisure, and his part was most easily played by men who happened to be in such a position. It was very easy and natural for a prince or a prominent person to play at being as philosophical as Hamlet or Theseus in the Midsummer Night's Dream. And from very early ages, we find ourselves in the presence of these princely intellectuals. In fact, we find one of them in the very first recorded ages of the world, sitting on the primeval throne that looked over ancient Egypt. The most intense interest of the incident of Akhenaten, commonly called the heretic pharaoh, lies in the fact that he was the one example, at any rate before Christian times, of one of those royal philosophers who set himself to fight popular mythology in the name of private philosophy. Most of them assumed the attitude of Marcus Aurelius, who is in many ways the model of this sort of monarch and sage. Marcus Aurelius has been blamed for tolerating the pagan amphitheater or the Christian martyrdoms. But it was characteristic, for this sort of man really thought of popular religion just as he thought of popular circuses. Of him, Professor Fillmore has profoundly said, "A great and good man, and he knew it." The heretic pharaoh had a philosophy more earnest and perhaps more humble. For there is a corollary to the conception of being too proud to fight. It is that the humble have to do most of the fighting. Anyhow, the Egyptian prince was simple enough to take his own philosophy seriously, and alone among such intellectual princes he effected a sort of coup d'etat, hurling down the high gods of Egypt with one imperial gesture, and lifting up for all men, like a blazing mirror of monotheistic truth, the disk of the universal sun. He had other interesting ideas often to be found in such idealists. In the sense in which we speak of a little Englander, he was a little Egypter. In art, he was a realist because he was an idealist, for realism is more impossible than any other ideal. But after all, there falls on him something of the shadow of Marcus Aurelius, stalked by the shadow of Professor Fillmore. That is the matter with this noble sort of prince, is that he has nowhere quite escaped being something of a prig. Priggishness is so pungent a smell that it clings, amid the faded spices even, to an Egyptian mummy. That was the matter with the heretic pharaoh, as with a good many other heretics. It was that he probably never paused to ask himself whether there was anything in the popular beliefs and tales of people less educated than himself. And, as already suggested, there was something in them. There was a real human hunger in all that element of feature and locality, that procession of deities like enormous pet animals, in that unwearied watching at certain haunted spots, in all the many wanderings of mythology. Nature may not have the name of Isis, Isis may not be really looking for Osiris, but it is true that nature is really looking for something. Nature is always looking for the supernatural. Something much more definite was to satisfy that need, but a dignified monarch with a disk of the sun did not satisfy it. The royal experiment failed amid a roaring reaction of popular superstitions, in which the priests rose on the shoulders of the people and ascended the thrones of the kings. The next great example I shall take of the princely sage is Gautama, the great Lord Buddha. I know he is not generally classed merely with the philosophers, but I am more and more convinced from all information that reaches me that this is the real interpretation of his immense importance. He was by far the greatest and best of these intellectuals born in the purple. His reaction was perhaps the noblest and most sincere of all the resultant actions of that combination of thinkers and of thrones. For his reaction was renunciation. Marcus Aurelius was content to say, with a refined irony, that even in a palace life could be lived well. The fierier Egyptian king concluded that it could be lived even better after a palace revolution. But the great Gautama was the only one of them who proved he could really do without his palace. One fell back on toleration, and the other on revolution. But after all, there is something more absolute about abdication. Abdication is perhaps the one really absolute action of an absolute monarch. The Indian prince, reared in oriental luxury and pomp, deliberately went out and lived the life of a beggar. That is magnificent, but it is not war. That is, it is not necessarily a crusade in the Christian sense. It does not decide the question of whether the life of a beggar was the life of a saint or the life of a philosopher. It does not decide whether this great man is really to go into the tub of Diogenes or the cave of Saint Jerome. Now, those who seem to be nearest to the study of Buddha, and certainly those who write most clearly and intelligently about him, convince me, for one, that he was simply a philosopher who founded a successful school of philosophy, and was turned into a sort of devus, or sacred being, merely by the more mysterious and unscientific atmosphere of all such traditions in Asia. So that it is necessary to say, at this point, a word about that invisible yet vivid borderline that we cross in passing from the Mediterranean into the mystery of the East. Perhaps there are no things out of which we get so little of the truth as the truisms, especially when they are really true. We are all in the habit of saying certain things about Asia which are true enough, but which hardly help us, because we do not understand their truth. As that Asia is old, or looks to the past, or is not progressive. Now it is true that Christendom is more progressive, in a sense that has very little to do with the rather provincial notion of an endless fuss of political improvement. Christendom does believe, for Christianity does believe, that man can eventually get somewhere, here or hereafter, or in various ways according to various doctrines. The world's desire can somehow be satisfied, as desires are satisfied, whether by a new life, or an old love, or some form of positive possession and fulfillment. For the rest, we all know there is a rhythm and not a mere progress in things, that things rise and fall. Only with us, the rhythm is a fairly free and incalculable rhythm. For most of Asia, the rhythm has hardened into a recurrence. It is no longer merely a rather topsy-turvy sort of world. It is a wheel. What has happened to all those highly intelligent and highly civilized peoples is that they have been caught up in a sort of cosmic rotation, of which the hollow hub is really nothing. In that sense, the worst part of existence is that it may just as well go on like that forever. That is what we really mean when we say that Asia is old, or unprogressive, or looking backwards. That is why we see even her curved swords as arcs broken from the blinding wheel. Why we see her serpentine ornament as returning everywhere, like a snake that is never slain. It has very little to do with the political varnish of progress. All Asiatics might have top hats on their heads, but if they had this spirit still in their hearts, they would only think that the hats would vanish and come round again, like the planets. not that running after a hat could lead them to heaven or even to home. Now, when the genius of Buddha arose to deal with the matter, this sort of cosmic sentiment was already common to almost everything in the East. There was indeed the jungle of an extraordinarily extravagant and almost asphyxiating mythology. Nevertheless, it is possible to have more sympathy with this popular fruitfulness in folklore than with some of the higher pessimism that might have withered it. It must always be remembered, however, when all fair allowances are made, that a great deal of spontaneous Eastern imagery really is idolatry, the local and literal worship of an idol. This is probably not true of the ancient Brahminical system, at least as seen by Brahmins, but that phrase alone will remind us of a reality of much greater moment. This great reality is the caste system of ancient India. It may have had some of the practical advantages of the guild system of medieval Europe, but it contrasts not only with that Christian democracy, but with every extreme type of Christian aristocracy, in the fact that it does really conceive the social superiority as a spiritual superiority. This not only divides it fundamentally from the fraternity of Christendom, but leaves it standing like a mighty and terraced mountain of pride between the relatively egalitarian levels both of Islam and of China. But the fixity of this formation through thousands of years is another illustration of that spirit of repetition that has marked time from time immemorial. Now, we may also presume the prevalence of another idea which we associate with the Buddhists as interpreted by the Theosophists. As a matter of fact, some of the strictest Buddhists repudiate the idea, and still more scornfully repudiate the Theosophists. But whether the idea is in Buddhism, or only in the birthplace of Buddhism, or only in a tradition or a travesty of Buddhism, it is an idea entirely proper to this principle of recurrence. I mean, of course, the idea of reincarnation. But reincarnation is not really a mystical idea. It is not really a transcendental idea, or in that sense, a religious idea. Mysticism conceives something transcending experience. Religion seeks glimpses of a better good or a worse evil than experience can give. Reincarnation need only extend experiences in the sense of repeating them. It is no more transcendental for a man to remember what he did in Babylon before he was born than to remember what he did in Brixton before he had a knock on the head. His successive lives need not be any more than human lives, under whatever limitations burden human life. It has nothing to do with seeing God or even conjuring up the devil. In other words, reincarnation as such does not necessarily escape from the wheel of destiny. In some sense, it is the wheel of destiny. And whether it was something that Buddha founded, or something that Buddha found, or something that Buddha entirely renounced when he found, it is certainly something having the general character of that Asiatic atmosphere in which he had to play his part. And the part he played was that of an intellectual philosopher, with a particular theory about the right intellectual attitude towards it. I can understand that Buddhists might resent the view that Buddhism is merely a philosophy, if we understand by a philosophy merely an intellectual game such as the Greek sophists played, tossing up worlds and catching them like balls. Perhaps a more exact statement would be that Buddha was a man who made a metaphysical discipline, which might even be called a psychological discipline. He proposed a way of escaping from all this recurrent sorrow, and that was simply by getting rid of the delusion that is called desire. It was emphatically not that we should get what we want better by restraining our impatience for part of it, or that we should get it in a better way or in a better world. It was emphatically that we should leave off wanting it. If once a man realized that there is really no reality, that everything, including his soul, is in dissolution at every instant, he would anticipate disappointment and be intangible to change, existing, insofar as he could be said to exist, in a sort of ecstasy of indifference. The Buddhists call this beatitude, and we will not stop our story to argue the point. Certainly, to us, it is indistinguishable from despair. I do not see, for instance, why the disappointment of desire should not apply as much to the most benevolent desires as to the most selfish ones. Indeed, the Lord of Compassion seems to pity people for living rather than for dying. For the rest, an intelligent Buddhist wrote, "The explanation of popular Chinese and Japanese Buddhism is that it is not Buddhism." That has doubtless ceased to be a mere philosophy, but only by becoming a mere mythology. One thing is certain. It has never become anything remotely resembling what we call a church. It will appear only a jest to say that all religious history has really been a pattern of noughts and crosses. But I do not by noughts mean nothings, but only things that are negative compared with the positive shape or pattern of the other. And though the symbol is of course only a coincidence, it is a coincidence that really does coincide. The mind of Asia can really be represented by a round zero, if not in the sense of a cipher, at least of a circle. The great Asiatic symbol of a serpent with its tail in its mouth is really a very perfect image of a certain idea of unity and recurrence that does indeed belong to the Eastern philosophies and religions. It really is a curve that in one sense includes everything, and in another sense comes to nothing. In that sense, it does confess, or rather boast, that all argument is an argument in a circle. And though the figure is but a symbol, we can see how sound is the symbolic sense that produces it. The parallel symbol of the wheel of Buddha, generally called the swastika. The cross is a thing at right angles, pointing boldly in opposite directions. But the swastika is the same thing in the very act of returning to the recurrent curve. The crooked cross is in fact a cross turning into a wheel. Before we dismiss even these symbols as if they were arbitrary symbols, we must remember how intense was the imaginative instinct that produced them, or selected them, both in the East and in the West. The cross has become something more than a historical memory. It does convey, almost as by a mathematical diagram, the truth about the real point at issue, the idea of a conflict stretching outwards into eternity. It is true, and even tautological, to say that the cross is the crux of the whole matter. In other words, the cross, in fact as well as figure, does really stand for the idea of breaking out of the circle that is everything and nothing. It does escape from the circular argument by which everything begins and ends in the mind. Since we are still dealing in symbols, it might be put in a parable in the form of that story about Saint Francis, which says that the birds, departing with his benediction, could wing their way into the infinities of the four winds of heaven, their tracks making a vast cross upon the sky. For compared with the freedom of that flight of birds, the very shape of the swastika is like a kitten chasing its tail. In a more popular allegory, we might say that when Saint George thrust his spear into the monster's jaws, he broke in upon the solitude of the self-devouring serpent and gave it something to bite besides its own tail. But while many fancies might be used as figures of the truth, the truth itself is abstract and absolute, though it is not very easy to sum up except by such figures. Christianity does appeal to a solid truth outside itself, to something which is in that sense external as well as eternal. It does declare that things are really there, or, in other words, that things are really things. In this, Christianity is at one with common sense. But all religious history shows that this common sense perishes, except where there is Christianity to preserve it. It cannot otherwise exist, or at least endure, because mere thought does not remain sane. In a sense, it becomes too simple to be sane. The temptation of the philosophers is simplicity rather than subtlety. They are always attracted by insane simplifications, as men poised above abysses are fascinated by death and nothingness and the empty air. It needed another kind of philosopher to stand poised upon the pinnacle of the temple and keep his balance without casting himself down. One of these two obvious explanations is that everything is a dream and a delusion, and there is nothing outside the ego. Another is that all things recur. Another, which is said to be Buddhist and is certainly Oriental, is the idea that what is the matter with us is our creation, in the sense of our colored differentiation and personality, and that nothing will be well till we are again melted into one unity. By this theory, in short, the creation was the fall. It is important historically because it was stored up in the dark heart of Asia, and went forth at various times, in various forms, over the dim borders of Europe. Here we can place the mysterious figure of Manes, or Manichaeus, the mystic of inversion, whom we should call a pessimist, parent of many sects and heresies. Here, in a higher place, the figure of Zoroaster. He has been popularly identified with another of these two simple explanations, the equality of evil and good, balanced and battling in every atom. He also is of the school of sages that may be called mystics. And from the same mysterious Persian garden came upon ponderous wings Mithras, the unknown god, to trouble the last twilight of Rome. That circle or disk of the sun set up in the morning of the world by the remote Egyptian has been a mirror and a model for all the philosophers. They have made many things out of it, and sometimes gone mad about it, especially when, as in these Eastern sages, the circle became a wheel going round and round in their heads. But the point about them is that they all think that existence can be represented by a diagram instead of a drawing, and the rude drawings of the childish myth-makers are a sort of crude and spirited protest against that view. They cannot believe that religion is really not a pattern, but a picture. Still less can they believe that it is a picture of something that really exists outside our minds. Sometimes the philosopher paints the disc all black and calls himself a pessimist. Sometimes he paints it all white and calls himself an optimist. Sometimes he divides it exactly into halves of black and white and calls himself a dualist. Like those Persian mystics to whom I wish there was space to do justice. None of them could understand a thing that began to draw the proportions just as if they were real proportions, disposed in the living fashion, which the mathematical draftsman would call disproportionate. Like the first artist in the cave, it revealed to incredulous eyes the suggestion of a new purpose in what looked like a wildly crooked pattern. He seemed only to be distorting the diagram when he began, for the first time in all the ages, to trace the lines of a form, and of a face. End of chapter 6.